Welcome back to Food Toxicology. I'm Greg Muller, the instructor for the course. When we talk about things toxic, quite often we fall into a trap of thinking about worst-case scenarios. And in terms of the popular media representations of toxicology and all things toxic, cancer has to be perhaps one of the most dreaded outcomes of toxicosis. What we're going to try to do today in our lecture called Teratogenesis, Mutagenesis, and Carcinogenesis, look at these three toxic endpoints, try to get a level of familiarity with the terminology, the processes. The difficulty that we have in a course like this is the ability to bring in all of the understanding that is currently available. And I'll direct you to other resources, other courses, fields of study that deal with this at a much greater depth than perhaps we can in this course. Our goal here is actually to try and give you at least an introductory understanding of the relationship of these three toxic outcomes and how food toxicology might have a relationship to each. Our learning objectives for today, we're going to try to define what each of these are: teratogenesis, mutagenesis, and carcinogenesis. We're going to try to describe the relevance of the various cellular processes, nuclear processes of replication, transcription, and translation, and how it relates to teratogenesis, mutagenesis, and carcinogenesis. We're going to try as well to summarize the mechanism of these three outcomes and try to differentiate them, although there is some significant crossover between the three. In other words, a mutation might have a toxic endpoint of cancer. We're going to try to discuss some examples of known teratogens, mutagens, and carcinogens. And again, your readings for this particular lecture module will help you identify some of those in detail that I can't explore in just a lecture. Now, one of the things as we start an understanding of these endpoints, we have to go back and brief ourselves once again on the molecules of life, because in fact, we're going to be damaging or changing the molecules of life in these particular toxic processes. So some of these toxicants can actually react with or modify DNA. And the change here in terms of differentiating it from some of the other toxic endpoints that we've talked about in the course is that these changes, although they may be acute damage or maybe even chronic damage, they can actually lead to a heritable change. And so the offspring, in a certain sense, suffers the consequence of the toxic exposure of the parents. And so that is a very strong difference between some of the aspects of mutagenesis and teratogenesis that we don't have in some of the other manifestations of toxicosis. There also can be just a change in cellular growth or development, okay, in terms of a mutagenesis of an individual. Now, in terms of the processes and the molecules of life, the process of replication perpetuates the genetic code, the genetic information, in terms of copying the DNA from, in a cellular division process. We then have transcription and translation that express this genetic information quite often in terms of the diversity of proteins that provide many of our life processes. I've shown this cartoon before, and I'll show it again just to make sure that you've got a good background, but we've got those three basic processes of replication, transcription, and translation. Replication happening within the nucleus, and then in the ribosomes, we've got RNA that actually helps produce proteins in the cytoplasm. Those proteins, with their great diversity of structure and function, make us who we are. And there is a tremendous opportunity for disruption of all of the consequences of this orchestrated process. Now, reviewing again some of the protein functions that we have proteins that form antibodies, and they recognize molecules of invading organisms, an immunological factor. They form receptors, which help translate and recognize other proteins or hormones in terms of communication within the body. They form enzymes that help assemble or digest. They form neurotransmitters or hormones. And they also provide structure to many cells and to many organelles, such as channels and pores. Now, some of the endpoints that we're going to talk about when we talk about these heritable changes or changes to the molecules of life include teratogenesis, mutagenesis, and carcinogenesis. Teratogenesis comes from the Greek word monster. It actually is the origin or production of malformed fetuses or offspring, sometimes with reasonably horrible consequences. Quite often, teratogenesis, which may be embryonic in terms of its initial stages, actually disrupts the production of a viable fetus. There we have also mutagenesis, where we can define that as the production of a mutation or a change in the genetic code of an organism. And we have carcinogenesis, which is a cancer formation. We'll go through all the different definitions of various types of cancer, the jargon, if you will, and it includes carcinoma and malignant neoplasms, new cell growth. In terms of DNA replication, to review, we see a structure in DNA that does imply replication. We all wish we were as bright as we are now, knowing what we know 150 years ago. DNA occurs via multiple enzyme action. Its helix unravels in terms of replication. The strands part, and then the DNA replicates. It's a part of the mitosis and meiosis processes. And for those of you that have had biology, know that this process is not always perfect. We do have repair enzymes to go back and fix imperfections from this particular process. It is not perfect. What we find in terms of replication is that it does duplicate cell DNA. In mitosis, we have one somatic cell with two N chromosomes that divides to create two cells with two N chromosomes, and so we get a complete replication there. In the number and the quality and quantity of the chromosomes should be conserved in this process. We trigger mitosis with various proteins and receptors that can include external signals, some hormones, internal factors, growth factors to start these cell replication, cell division processes. In meiosis, it's the process where germ cells divide into gametes. And because this is a part of sexual reproduction, these cell divisions, and there are two cell divisions, produce four daughter cells. Each one of these has a different set of chromosomes. And the fact is, in terms of genetic diversity, it only has one of the sets required for the final organism. That other set will come to it via fertilization in sexual reproduction. Now, in terms of DNA transcription, the DNA is copied via this expendable messenger RNA molecule. It codes for specific proteins, and this occurs in the nucleus of the cell in terms of this particular transcription process. The translation that follows occurs in the cytosol. The messenger RNA leaves the nucleus, interacts with transfer RNA, amino acids, and enzymes to form these building blocks. This transfer RNA has three base codons, and these each correspond to coding for a different amino acid. There can be obviously disruptions there, coding or miscoding. These amino acids are added one at a time to form a chain. This becomes a polypeptide. These polypeptides correspond to a proton with a protein with a specific amino acid sequence. Now, in terms of transcription and translation, when we have this double strand of nucleotides, they're made up of nucleic acids in sugar and phosphate groups. The nucleotides are referred to as cytosine, thymine, uracil, adenine, and guanine, CTUAG. We get base pairing across specific nucleotides. The base pairing occurs adenine, thymine, guanine, cytosine, ATGC. This base pairing allows for the structure, the helical structure of the DNA. The gene is the base sequences of bases that code for a specific sequence of amino acids, as I said before. And the codon is the sequence of three bases that actually code for a single amino acid. So we will get these codes, and you can find in your book tables of those codes. ACG, for example, codes for serine, AAA codes for lysine. And so these present, because they are chemicals, the opportunity for chemical reaction and upset in a toxicosis episode. Transcription is a copying. The DNA unzips and enzymes make an RNA copy. There are some differences in terms of the copy that is made. T is translated for uracil, and so we get a UA, not a TA. We get deoxyribose on the molecules instead of ribose. Messenger RNA formation does allow for transport of this substrate to the cytoplasm. The next process is translation, and this is the protein formation. The messenger RNA actually provides the blueprint. The RNA supports transfer RNA in terms of amino acid transport. In terms of the structure and function of DNA, these nucleotides form chains. The nucleotides form a codon. The multiple codons form a gene. These multiple genes then form chromosomes, and these multiple chromosomes give us our DNA, and that's the relationship of the substructure to the function of DNA. These graphics give you an idea, again, two-dimensional structural representations of a three-dimensional alpha helix. It's important, again, just so that you realize there is a potential for interaction of chemicals with these molecules of life. Many of these chemicals, and especially on the next slide, which is a close-up in this case of a DNA-RNA complex, you can see many nitrogen and oxygen residues, nitrogen residues being purple-colored and the oxygen residues being red-colored in this. These are electro-rich, electron-rich zones that are perhaps susceptible to electrophilic attack. For instance, from free radicals. And so there is an opportunity in the molecules of life for chemical reaction and therefore disruption of the transcription and translation processes. Some of the errors that can occur in base pairing. Some of the repair enzymes and other enzymes can be disrupted. Some of the regulatory genes, the operons, and the termination sequences can actually be modified. There can be a change in methylation patterns. There can be some consequences in some of the post-transcriptional translational processing of some of the end products. All of these might end up with a toxic consequence in terms of mutagenesis, carcinogenesis, or teratogenesis. In terms of potential DNA chemical interactions, we have the potential direct alkylation. If we have an alkylating chemical, mustard gas in a chemical warfare agent, the mustards were strong alkylating reagents used in chemical warfare attack. It not only had acute toxicosis, but had the potential for mutagenesis. It provides the ability to form a covalent adduct between the DNA and the chemical, and we'll see that on one of our further slides here. We can have intercalcation, calcation, non-covalent binding of a chemical between an adjacent base pairs. We can have cross-linkage, an inter or intra strand covalent binding of a chemical. And we can also essentially cut the DNA or break the DNA, scissor it, in terms of one or both strands of the DNA itself. In terms of the formation of DNA adducts, the mechanism of chemical carcinogenesis and DNA modification by chemicals is an active area of research. Aflatoxin B1, a mycotoxin found on many grains such as corn and barley. Aflatoxin B1 is a chemical that is electrophilic. It has a binding capacity with guanine. This shows it in a more of a three-dimensional representation. This is the molecular arrangement between the nucleotide and the aflatoxin residue. These have been borne out in terms of its potential toxic consequences. Let's switch over and for an analysis of teratogenesis. Teratology is the study of the frequency and causation and development of congenital malformations in the conceptus. There's complex mechanisms not totally understood in terms of the relationship of chemicals to teratogenesis. We do understand that there are certain critical time frames in terms of formation of structures or substructures in the organism, in terms of embryogenesis, and that disruption during those critical times will yield a malformed fetus. There are some natural, as you will, bad path, spontaneous abortions. There are mistakes that do happen in terms of the development of organisms. In the human, the rate of spontaneous abortion is estimated to be somewhere between 10 to 20%. 1 in 10 to 2, 1 in 5 conceptions resolve in spontaneous abortion for whatever reason, and there are multiple reasons. In humans, the critical time period is in the first 8 weeks of gestation. Typically, you have probably seen that they tell new mothers not to be drinking or smoking cigarettes during their pregnancy. The potential outcome of teratogenesis, fetal alcohol syndrome, for example, in terms of a mutation, is perhaps one of the consequences of excessive alcohol consumption during gestation. It happens in terms of the embryonic stage, and there can be morphological defects in specialized tissues or in organs. There can be the development of neoplastic endpoints in the fetus, in other words, the pre-stages of cancer as one potential developmental consequence of teratogenesis. There is a pretty healthy list, healthy is probably not the correct word to use, of known human teratogens. Unfortunately, and some of these are in your readings, we come to know about these teratogens because of the bad consequences, unplanned events, unknown certain toxic interactions of a chemical that was designed for one particular purpose and ends up having a toxic consequence. DES or diethylstilbestrol is a classic case study in teratogenesis of a synthetic human-made pharmaceutical. This photo gives you an example of some of the structural defects associated with teratogenesis. This is a five-legged frog. It has one too many limbs. This was one of the frogs recovered, I believe it was Minnesota, in the late 1990s. There was an observation. Actually, it started with a, I believe, a junior high school class doing some ecological studies. They happened on a collection of frogs with various malformations, missing limbs, extra limbs. In terms of the media, the consequences, the observations of teratogenesis are always linked to toxic exposures, and so the chase was on in this particular analysis, find the toxin that was responsible for these mutations and teratogenesis. In fact, in this particular case, although there were several chemicals, and typically pesticides that were associated with these particular environments, the actual mechanistic analysis of the teratogenesis was an infectious process. So it was a biological process in early stages of embryogenesis, although there was an environmental quality linkage in that this particular fluke, I believe, seemed to thrive in highly nutrient-laden waters. And so the whole ecological impacts of nutrients in this aquatic ecosystem did perhaps have a linkage to this particular teratogenesis. This is an example of a gross malformation. This is ovine cyclopia. This is from the components, the toxic components in Veratrum. Skunk cabbage is one of the common names. False heliobore is another. It's a fairly dramatic teratogenesis from a naturally occurring compound when the sheep are exposed in utero while the mother is grazing and happens across this particular plant compound. Fairly dramatic teratogenesis. Another example of teratogenesis in livestock is a syndrome known as crooked calf disease. It results from ingestion of the quinolizidin-type alkaloids, one being anhydrine from the lupin plant. Its manifestation in terms of its physical morphology is the bowed leg and arched back. The livestock born with this syndrome often survive, although a challenged life, even still. It is very dramatic in terms of its physical manifestation. A fairly disturbing case study has to do with the human impact of a similar birth defect from lupin. This particular case study started in September 1980. When a young newborn was a baby boy was brought to a clinic with severe bone deformities in his arms and hands and a partial absence of the forearm bones and absent thumbs. There was some medical history taken. There was some follow-up investigation of potential birth defects from regional herbicide spraying. In a certain sense, they were looking for possible causative agents. In terms of follow-up investigation, the mother did provide some evidence that her goats, and they lived on a dairy farm, a goat dairy farm, and drank the milk products from those goats, that her goats also gave birth to kids that were stillborn or with deformed legs that looked a little bit like this crooked calf sort of syndrome. They also found that the family dog gave birth to puppies. The family dog was also exposed to the goat milk of the goats that did feed in the area where lupin was available. Local goat's milk was a common item in their household, and the mother did consume this particular product during her pregnancy. They did find, in terms of follow-up investigation, sufficient rangeland in this Northern California area with the lupin growing on it, in addition to some other toxic plants, including hemlock and skunk cabbage. This particular, because we don't do clinical trials on humans, there is a tremendous amount of circumstantial evidence that this was a lupin anhydrine demonstrated birth defect. Some follow-up analyses at regional universities did identify that the lupin alkaloids are available in goat milk following ingestion of lupin and lupin seeds. And so the potential for causation is there, although in this particular case, an N=1, a very unfortunate situation, but one without a firm resolution in terms of cause and effect. Our next area of analysis is going to be mutagenesis, and this is where we have somatic cell mutations yielding some metabolic dysfunction, potentially leading to carcinogenesis. In germ cell mutation, we have the potential for heritable change, as I said before, that the sins of the father become, unfortunately, the sins of the offspring in terms of an inherited mutation. We can have a point mutation where we have a base substitution, including base analogs. Quite often, these are found in natural products. Some mushrooms, for example, their toxic mode of action are presenting base analogs, false bases that substitute in and cause a mutation effect. There can be a frame shift. The book outlines how these particular instances of mutation actually do happen in terms of base rearrangement. There can also be a chromosomal aberration that yields a structural anomaly in terms of the chromosomes, or a numerical anomaly, and we'll see that in a karyotype analysis. Karyotypes are patterns that are photographed during metaphase They help us examine for chromosomal defects. And so we take a look and we outline and enumerate all the chromosomes in trying to investigate a mutation-based cause for a particular physiological outcome, for instance, an enzyme deficiency or a morphological challenge. This gives us an idea of the 23 chromosomes, their paired chromosomes, all the way through to the XY, which are the sexually secondary sexual characteristic determining chromosomes. Females are XX, males are XY. You'll notice that the Y chromosome is pretty stunted relative to the X chromosome, which does in fact carry a tremendous amount of genetic information on it. In terms of the aberrations that karyotyping help us identify are aneuploidy or polyploidy. It helps us take a look at either the loss or gain of the various complete chromosomes, the change in the number, whether it's an absence of one chromosome or the addition of an extra one. Because these are microscopically visible, this is a way to confirm a potential mutation, heritable disease defect. You've probably heard of Down syndrome, which is a 21-plus trisomy. So we have an actual extra chromosome here on chromosome 21. Klinefelter syndrome, Turner syndrome, these have to do with secondary sexual characteristics. XXY, Klinefelter syndrome, two X chromosomes and a Y chromosome in terms of the sexually differentiating chromosomes. These syndromes typically in Jacobson syndrome, which is XYY or supermale syndrome, and Klinefelter's and Turner's, typically these chromosomal aberrations will yield sterile offspring. One of the ways we examine chemicals for mutagenic effects is a simple test developed by Bruce Ames at University of California at Berkeley. In the Ames test, as it's come to known, we take Salmonella bacteria. This particular strain has a histidine coating defect, and so in fact it doesn't reproduce quite well. What we do is we dose these cultures, these Salmonella cultures, with potentially mutagenic chemicals. And observe to see if we mutate it and essentially change this defect to allow for cell division and growth. Essentially, if we see cell division and growth, we are observing a potential mutation because the initial strain did not have that capability. When we do this test, we add the Salmonella strain, we add the test chemical, and typically we'll also add some rat hepatocytes, because we want to look at the metabolic products of biotransformation and judge if they, in fact, are the mutagenic agents. And again, the outcome of this test, that growth, will indicate that a chemical compound is a mutagen. Well, let's switch over now to carcinogenesis. Carcinogenesis is a complex orchestration of chemical and biochemical and physical cellular processes. It is typically regarded as a multi-step, multifactorial disease, although we have models of one-hit cancer. In terms of carcinogenesis, we have a procarcinogen or a carcinogen. A procarcinogen can be a non-reactive until biotransformation has made it into a carcinogen, so this encompasses kind of both cases of bioactivation or not. In terms of carcinogenesis, the interaction of this chemical with DNA will directly yield to mutation and then cancer, and this is the one-hit theory of cancer. In terms of a multi-step pathway, this will yield this initial mutation, followed by some promoting agent that encourages cell reproduction of these mutated cells in a promotion process yielding cancer. And so we not only have a carcinogen, but we have a promoting agent, and so it's a multifactorial disease in terms of requiring an initiator chemical and a promoter chemical. Some of the definitions associated with cancer, in broad-based cancer is a malignant tumor that has the ability to metastasize or invade some of the surrounding tissues. A neoplasm or tumor is a general term that we find for uncontrolled growth of cells that becomes progressively worse with time. Neoplasia is the growth of new tissue with abnormal and unregulated cell proliferation. The good cancer diagnosis, if you have one, is that we have a benign tumor, a tumor that does not metastasize. Metastasis is a more negative outcome of a cancer diagnosis, and this is a cancer that has the ability to establish these secondary outcroppings or tumor growth at new locations. The fact is, cancer is typically a disease that challenges other tissues in terms of blood flow, space. There can be significant pain and organ destruction associated with these neoplasia. Carcinoma is a malignant tumor that actually arises in the epithelium, so it's an epithelial cancer. It's the most common form of cancer. It usually spreads in the lymphatic system. And quite often you'll look at, in a diagnosis of carcinoma, you'll look at sentinel lymph nodes to see if, in fact, it is staged beyond the original site of the tumor growth. Sarcoma is a malignant tumor in muscle or connective tissue, so it's just a beginning originating tissue differentiation. It's usually spread in the bloodstream, and it frequently metastasizes in the lung with negative outcome. In terms of multistage carcinogenesis, when we have initiation, we have some sort of chemical or a virus or some sort of spontaneous cause of a DNA lesion. We then have some cell division that perpetuates this DNA lesion. If it doesn't get promoted, there may not be an outcome. We find that some chemicals can both initiate and promote, and some can just remain as kind of a precursor stage and not promoted. I've read one estimate that we get something like 100 hits of quote-unquote cancer cells every day in our bodies. Our immune system, lack of promotion, genetic defects of those particular cells actually allow them to not resolve and develop into a cancer. In terms of the one hit theory, it is going to be a non-threshold reversible process in terms of initiation to cancer. Now, these initiated cells, typically there's no phenotypic difference from the parent cells. They have some sort of excess or deficiency of enzymes of various types. They typically will develop some resistance to cytotoxic chemicals. They may have faster or slower metabolism, and it's this property that actually makes them a product or a challenge in terms of chemotherapy. We try to, for instance, give cytotoxic drugs, chemotherapy reagents, to a patient in hopes that the cancer cells will uptake these cytotoxic drugs faster than the surrounding tissues. These cells have impaired cellular communication. They have enhanced response to various growth factors and resistance to terminal differentiation. In other words, a differentiation that is going to terminate the cell growth. In terms of promotion, we find that there is a change in the microenvironment of cells. The chemical, viral, or spontaneous induced clonal proliferation helps these initiated cells. The growth control factors and immune function, endocrine control, communication, metabolic, and apoptosis all help in terms of changing the proliferation of these cells. This is typically a multi-hit, high-dose kind of promotion. It sometimes is regarded as reversible or a threshold effect. There's been some arguments that, in fact, in many of our rodent cancer assays, these result from a high-dose cellular damage, repeated cellular damage from non-realistic rodent doses. Yes, they do develop cancer, but it is not because of a direct carcinogenesis of the chemical, but because of the tissue or cellular damage associated with these very, very high doses. In terms of the progression of multi-stage carcinogenesis, these cells demonstrate a complete loss of growth control, some instability in their karyotype. They do lose or gain chromosomal fragments. They might exhibit DNA demethylation or deregulation. They exhibit some gene amplification, some error-prone DNA repair. It's identifiably irreversible, and there might be some similar mechanisms as we have observed in promotion. Now, it is useful for us to classify different types of carcinogens and how they have an impact on cells. Genotoxic is the term that we use to refer to a chemical that can act directly on DNA or expression of DNA during translation. And so it can yield some DNA replication errors, point mutations, chromosomal aberration. So for instance, an alkylating agent like mustard gas is genotoxic because it has a direct reactivity with the DNA molecule. As opposed to epigenetic, where they're not DNA reactive and therefore they potentiate cancer, sometimes they'll change some cellular hormone or immune function with their potential toxic impact. This indirect mechanism essentially sets the stage for this uncontrolled cell replication and eventual carcinogenesis. Genotoxic carcinogens are capable of producing cancer by directly altering the genetic material of the target cells. These direct carcinogens with no metabolic activation are things like these alkylating agents, nasty critters, next detoxicants. We do have indirect carcinogens that do require some sort of metabolic activation, biotransformation, intoxication. PAHs, as we've discussed, and we'll take a look at how that happens in terms of a chemical reaction here in a moment, are one of a class of indirect carcinogens. Aromatic amines, nitrosamines, in terms of the reaction of nitrites and nitrates used in food processing with proteins in the gut have been linked to various types of human cancer. There can be some interaction of natural substances like mycotoxins, and we saw the reaction of aflatoxin B1 with forming a DNA adduct. And then inorganic carcinogens, typically the ones of highest consideration, nickel, chromium, cadmium, and arsenic in terms of heavy metal carcinogens. Now, in terms of epigenetic carcinogens, these quite often can be cytotoxic carcinogens that yield cell death. NTA, or triacetic acid, for a while used in detergents. The antioxidants were used in food processing, butyl hydroxy toluene, butyl hydroxyaldehyde, BHA, BHT, cytogenic carcinogens, tumor promoters, DDT and dioxin, various hormones like estradiol, DES, immunosuppressants used in transplant therapy like cyclosporin A, and then the repeated physical injury of particulates such as asbestos, yielding asbestosis and a particular type of lung cancer. In terms of epigenetic carcinogens, let's take a look at the carcinogenic activations of PAHs. This is benzopyrene. We talked about it, and we talked about this Bay region that is associated with carcinogenesis. In our biotransformation lecture, you notice that rat hepatocytes will actually yield chemicals that take this nonpolar chemical and try to set it up via phase one and phase two biotransformation with various glucuronides or sugar groups or sulfate groups out on this side of the molecule. In terms of its bioprocessing and biotransformation during its exposure to liver, there can be the formation of this epoxide, this 7,8 epoxide, which goes to a diol and then a 7,8 diol epoxide. This is a very reactive substrate. It is a substrate that is electrophilic and can directly react and form a DNA adduct. And so there is a an indirect activation of a particularly toxic compound. Some of the listings of proven human carcinogens, these come from studies of typically workplace exposure. Carcinogenesis is something that takes usually a decade or two to manifest itself. And so we don't do dose response trials in humans, but we do have occupational or environmental exposure. We find that aflatoxins, 4-aminobiphenyl, arsenic, benzene, benzidine, beryllium, bischloro, ethyl ether, cadmium, chromium-6. Chromium-6 is important because chromium occurs in nature as chromium. Chromium-6 is an oxidation state that has been used in paints and has caused some tremendous amount of cleanup concern from paint manufacturers. We find soot in terms of chimney sweeps and various lung disease, mineral oils, mustard gas, 2-naphthylamine, nickel, vinyl chloride. In terms of substance abuse, alcohol is associated with cancer, as is the chewing of betel nuts in many areas of the globe. Cigarette smoking is another risk for cancer. In terms of exposure to dust and fiber, asbestosis, silicosis, various soots, talcum and wood dust, chronic infection like H. pylori, which yields various gastric upsets, including abscesses in the gastrointestinal tract, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, HIV, liver fluke. The papillomavirus is associated with chronic infection and various cancers, and as well infection by the parasite schistosomes, which occur in natural water bodies. In terms of some of the initiator chemicals we might be exposed to in the food, many of these are genotoxic chemicals, PAHs, aromatic amines, heterocyclic amines, mycotoxins, nitrosamines, nitrosamids, all occur in some aspects of food. It's a potential for dose response in terms of exposure, but these chemicals are around us. We try and minimize and work with keeping our immune systems healthy, keeping our diets healthy in terms of the amount of fiber and nutrients that we have to minimize the impacts of some of these chemicals. Some of the promoter agents in food, BHT, saccharin, cholic acid, and TCDD, which occurs primarily in the liposphere and therefore impacts us through our food chain, especially through animal products. Alcohol, as well, is a promoting agent in food. Now, in terms of chemical cancer assessment, this table gives you a way that we classify chemicals according to their relative carcinogenicity. In terms of the groups, they're alphabetical: group A, B1, B2, C, D, and F. And in terms of the assessment, we look at the preponderance of data in terms of classifying them. For no evidence, up to probable human in terms of the amount of animal or human evidence. And then a known human carcinogen is a group A carcinogen. If you work with this chemical in a laboratory, for example, or an industrial situation, you're going to have a tremendous amount of personal protective apparatus on to prevent exposure. These allow us to rank the relative concern over particular chemicals relative to animal tests. Now, animal tests tell us some things. They don't tell us everything. They are used actively in risk assessment. There typically is the application of a safety factor associated with exposure. But in terms of rodent study, there's great debate about the meaning of rodent cancer studies and the potential risk to humans. Has a lot to do with the dose used in these rodent studies. I'm going to focus just a little bit, give you an idea of food-related cancer, colorectal cancer. This cartoon gives you a little bit of an anatomical organization of the gastrointestinal tract in terms of the colon and the rectum. Obviously, with processing food, there is a relatively long period of potential exposure of food and food byproducts, food additives, food contaminants, and the toxins that might occur in the food system. There's a tremendously long, a relatively long exposure time in the colon. We do have the development potential of various new tissues referred to as colon polyps. This is a cartoon representation of what these would look like. This is actually the representation from a sigmoidoscopy. A sigmoidoscopy is a test recommended for many people over the age of 40 in terms of monitoring via visualization of the potential growth or development of polyps or pre-neoplastic lesions in the colon. In terms of risk factors for colon polyps, colon polyps themselves are a risk factor for colorectal cancer. The risk factors for polyps include being over 50, having some previous occurrence of these, some family history. If you have a high-fat, low-fiber diet, smoking, alcohol consumption, sedentary lifestyle, and being overweight are all risk factors for the presentation of colon polyps. In terms of the stages of colorectal cancer, again, this is a disease that is uncontrolled cell growth, stage 0, stage 1, stage 2. At stage 3, what you start seeing is a breakthrough from the intestinal lining or the serosa, as we learned, and perhaps even some infiltration of cancer cells into these sentinel lymph nodes, and therefore the potential for metastasis and distribution to other organs in the latter stages of this particular cancer. Found early, treated early, this can be resolved. Found late, the consequences are not so bright. In terms of common cancers in men and women, in men, prostate cancer is the leading cancer at 32%, lung, colorectal, urinary tract, leukemia, lymphoma. In women, breast cancer is the highest rate at 32%, then lung, colorectal, cancer of the uterus, and then leukemia. In the past century, death from cancer has been on a typically decreasing trend, and this has had a lot to do with early diagnosis and education about risk factors for cancer. We've improved our diets, we've limited toxins in terms of drinking water and food and air exposure. It was interesting that in the early part of the 1900s, after women started getting the right to vote and demanding a stronger role in American society, one of the offshoots of that is that more women started smoking. And so for the middle part of the last century, there was a dramatic increase in lung cancer diagnoses and lung cancer deaths in women. Those have started to, I think it peaked in about 1970, and they too have started to decline as males in lung cancer have started to decline as well. In terms of the causes of cancer, when we look at the epidemiological monitoring, diet is the chief lead cause of cancer. Tobacco smoking, 30%, sexual behavior and alcohol, infection, occupational exposure, UV radiation, and pollution. So dietary causes of cancer are the greatest at about 35%. In terms of the manifestations, we've talked about what happens on a molecular basis and also perhaps on a cellular basis, what happens when we get kind of the full staging of cancer, and typically in some cases with lethal outcome. This is kidney cancer. It doesn't necessarily have a lethal outcome, although this organ looks pretty enveloped. This is a tumor and that is just about the same size as the kidney itself. With kidney cancer that is not metastasized, the survivability, five-year survivability statistics are about 65%, so pretty good outcome. And cancers, if diagnosed earlier, is typically have more positive outcome. Liver cancer is uniformly greeted with negative outcomes because of the importance of this particular organ, its high blood flow. Liver cancer is a terminal diagnosis. As you know and understand, the importance of this particular organ in terms of biotransformation and processing of nutrients, you can understand why liver cells that are dominated by these cancer cells no longer function correctly, and so no longer can provide what is required for the maintenance of life processes. On the other side of the spectrum, in terms of diagnoses of cancer, basal cell carcinoma or sun cancer from too much exposure to the sun, especially in certain types of populations, is a very slow, very treatable cancer. If it in fact is found early on, it is typically cut out of the epidermis. New drugs now in terms of superficial basal cell carcinomas can actually be used in terms of marshaling an immune response to that area via an immune-mediated response to the chemical. Aldara is the name of the drug. Again, for superficial basal cell carcinoma, can be treated without any surgical intervention. Well, finally, what we're going to talk about real briefly here is an incident that happened in the past few years that many people involved in food, and even if you read the newspaper, have come to know as the acrylamide in food incident. This all started when some Swedish investigators were following up on some industrial exposures of acrylamide. These were workplace exposures. And in doing the analysis and the epidemiological workup, they were finding fairly elevated levels or unexpectedly elevated levels of acrylamide in the non-workplace exposed populations. It caused them to ask the questions, if they're not getting exposed to it in the workplace, where is their exposure? They started looking at food, and they started doing an analysis of several types of food products, and they showed that acrylamide levels, substantial acrylamide levels, were found in various fried and baked foods, including potato chips, french fries, and various biscuits and cereals. It forms, this chemical compound acrylamide forms, as a result of a reaction between various amino acids and sugars at high temperatures above 100 degrees centigrade. Because acrylamide is listed by international agencies as a probable human carcinogen, there became a great amount of concern about exposure to a probable human carcinogen in our food supply. These products are not easily taken off the shelf. They are a part of the diet. You talk about various biscuits that are baked at high temperature, fried foods. These are proliferative across the human diet. And so there was a tremendous problem in terms of doing the risk assessment. If for no other reason, if we were eating this dose of carcinogens, why weren't we all coming down with cancer? The three cancers associated with acrylamide toxicity are colorectal, bladder, and kidney cancer. And in the follow-up analyses to this, obviously we did have some rodent studies in terms of carcinogenesis, and we probably had some clinical data to establish it as a probable human carcinogen. The epidemiological studies that went back and looked at people's diets, their potential exposure to acrylamide, and their rate of increased cancers, colorectal, bladder, and kidney cancer, found that there really was not an epidemiological link. In fact, the epidemiological data showed that the highest potential doses of acrylamide showed a relative decrease in cancers, in these cancers, which the researchers then linked to, well, they might be eating higher fiber in their diet in terms of some of the baked goods that were associated with acrylamide. And so there was a confounding set of data here in the epidemiological studies that actually demonstrated that our concern over Krillamine food, although a concern for follow-up and analysis investigation, has not borne out in terms of risk in terms of the human population. All right. Well, next time we'll try to take some analyses of specific sorts of aspects of food toxicology. In the next series of lectures, we'll take a look at allergens in food. We'll start taking a look at food additives in food and some of the specific regulatory processes, as well as the potential toxicoses associated with these chemicals. Until that time, we'll see you later. Thank you so much.